talk about tonight is a slightly unusual shaila, a little bit sad, a little bit painful, a little bit interesting, a little bit of all of those. And the story goes as follows. Rabbi Leibowitz actually reached out to me this week about a shaila that he had gotten from Rabbi Yisrael Reisman. And Rabbi Reisman's shaila was as follows. And when you think about it, there are a number of other somewhat similar cases, which are not exactly the same, but maybe you can take some guidance from there. And I think this touches upon a very important issue as well, which has nothing to do with the halacha lemaisa, just the hashkafa here. So there's a couple that is having a lot of trouble attempting to conceive a child naturally. And after many, many, many failed attempts and extensive testing, the doctors have now informed them that there is no natural way for them to conceive. And in order to bear a child, they will need to go through IVF treatments. So the husband insists that he is not willing to do so because he feels that he is a Baal Bitachon, and someone who is a true believer will either be blessed with children or they won't. So he refuses to go ahead with IVF. And he believes that the IVF will not change the reality. His wife is distraught, as one can imagine, and has been trying valiantly to convince him that they should go ahead with the treatments, but he won't hear it. So she posed the following shaila. She wants to know, and again, just by way of introduction to this question, I'm not commenting on what kind of shalom bias this couple has. I'm not commenting on the need for therapy that probably is important in this case, leaving all of those considerations aside and whether this is a good idea for their marriage or not. The question that was posed was the following. She would like to naturally try to conceive, to be intimate with her husband, and immediately after that, to go to a clinic and have the sperm retrieval done without her husband's consent. So she plans not to tell him, and she wanted to know, is this allowed? Is she allowed to do a sperm retrieval without her husband's knowledge? Does he have ownership over his sperm, and therefore he has the ability to dictate how it should or should not be used? Or perhaps once it was emitted from his body, it's no longer shayach to him at all. This is a fascinating question, and it touches on so many different issues that we need to think about. I can't say I have a definitive answer, because I don't. But I think it's very, very interesting to consider all the different sides of this. So number one, when we talk about medical interventions, when we talk about the opportunity that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us to use technology and to use scientific breakthroughs, and then one decides, you know what, I don't want to make use of that because I believe as a Baal Bitachon that everything will be fine, that really is a very problematic hashkafa. That in and of itself, before you get into the details of this question, that in and of itself is a major problem. The Torah says, Lo sinasu es Hashem Elokeichem. What exactly does that pasuk mean? So the Ramban on Chumash explains what the pasuk means is, don't make the religion conditional. Don't say to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, well, if you do this for me, if you show me a sign, if you're going to give me something that will let me know that I should really believe in you, then I'll believe in you. If you're going to do X, then I'll do Y. If you perform a miracle for me, then I'll do this mitzvah. It cannot be conditional. Lo sinasu es Hashem Elokeichem. That's not the way it should work. That's the way the Ramban explains that pasuk. But other Rishonim say what it means is, Lo sinasu es Hashem Elokeichem means don't put yourself in a situation where HaKadosh Baruch Hu has to do a miracle for you. That is an inappropriate way to live life. Not only that, the Gemara says in Maseches Brachos that one is not allowed to daven for a miracle. So the Gemara there gives the following idea. The Gemara tells us, what if you have a situation where there's somebody who very much wants to have a baby boy, or somebody who very much wants to have a baby girl, whichever way it is. Am I allowed to be mispalo? Once the woman is already pregnant, are we allowed to be mispalo that it should be a boy or a girl? Or is that something that is considered to be inappropriate? Because after all, the gender has already been determined based on the fact that she's already way into the pregnancy. So the Gemara says it would be inappropriate to offer such a tefillah because it's already been decided whether this is going to be a boy or a baby girl. And similarly, the Shulchan Aruch writes the same, quoting a Gemara, what happens if somebody was on a business trip and now they come traveling back into the city and they hear ambulances are rushing down the block and they're nervous, they don't know what's going on and they have a concern that maybe they're rushing to their house. Not for any particular reason, but you're concerned that maybe it's coming from your house and you offer a tefillah, wherever the ambulances are going, they shouldn't be going to my house or to my block or to my neighbor. The Gemara says that would be an inappropriate tefillah because either they are or they're not. To offer a tefillah in advance, we should all be safe and everyone should be healthy. That's one thing. But to offer a tefillah now, ex post facto, to say that at this point, I ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu to help me out and make sure that the ambulance is not going to my house, that would seem to be inappropriate. That is being mispalo for an ace. Not only that, even if a person is being osik b'mitzvah, Even if the reason why I'm asking for a miracle to happen is because I want a mitzvah to be fulfilled, I'm still considered to be somewhat inappropriate for a person to ask for a nes, for a miracle, for that as well. The Rashba writes, "Afilu chasid shebechasidim." Even if you have the most righteous person, "Ein lahem rishus lasas b'malachtan derech habitachon rakidarko shalolam." A person, even if they're a great tzaddik, a great chassid, says the Rashba in the Tshuva, they still need to go out and get a job. And you cannot just say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to take care of everything, and my children won't starve, and we're going to be able to pay the mortgage and the rent. It doesn't work that way, says the Rashba, and that is not the way that we're supposed to live life. What I find fascinating is, even in the Beis HaMikdash itself, which if you look through Chazal, you see there were miracles that were happening every day in the Beis HaMikdash, but yet, the Gemara still tells us in a number of places that we shouldn't be somech al hanes. We shouldn't assume that the miracle is going to happen. We have to do our part. We have to do what's expected of us. So, for example, the Gemara says in Erevin Samach Gimel, even though every day there was a miraculous fire that came down min hashamayim, still the Gemara says, mitzvah lahavi min ahedyot. You're still supposed to light a fire, set up the bonfire on the Mizbeach, because that's the natural way for a fire to burn. I, the Kohanim, knew that every single day there was going to be a miracle, regardless of whatever they did or didn't do. No, but the Gemara still says it would be appropriate to do that. So there are a number of examples that the Gemara gives, even when it comes to Beis HaMikdash, you're not allowed to rely on a miracle. For example, the Gemara tells us as well, very interesting story the Gemara has. We know that the Lechem Apanim had a great miracle that was done to them. What was the Lechem Apanim? That Siduro Kisiluko. When you have fresh bread that you bake, it smells delicious, it tastes delicious, it's fresh, it's warm, it's hot. But a week later, after it's been sitting out in the Beis HaMikdash for an entire week on the Shulchan, it probably would not feel the same way. The Gemara says that was a miracle. Siluko kisiduro, the same kind of texture and flavor that it had when you put it in at the beginning of the week, right when it was fresh, that is the same kind of bread that was taken out at the end of the week when they removed the Lechem Apanim from the Shulchan. Okay, now says the Gemara, although that was the case, and that's certainly miraculous, the Gemara says there was a family that had the secret ingredient how you can bake bread and keep it as fresh as possible over the course of a week. And the Gemara tells us that there was a family by the name of Beis Garmo, and they used to pay them an extra amount of money that they should be the ones designated to bake the Lechem Apanim every week, because they knew this secret trick of what ingredients to put in to keep the bread fresh. Now, why do you need that? Why should we pay them extra? After all, the Lechem Apanim is going to be fresh, and the Gemara says that was a miracle. But the answer is, we do whatever we can. Ain somchan al hanes. And therefore, if we know about this group of people that knows how to bake in such a fashion, in such a manner, we will try to do everything we can to do this naturally, which is what Rabbeinu Bachai writes in his commentary on Chumash. The Ramban writes the same thing. Noach, when he built the Teva, the Pasuk says 120 years, he was involved in building the Teva. Why was he doing this for 120 years? Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu told him he had to. Why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu tell him he had to? Because he said, otherwise you're not going to be saved. So I ask you, now that he built himself a big cruise liner, do you think that it was a natural phenomenon that he was saved? It was obviously miraculous. The whole world was flooded. How did his boat not capsize? How did his boat not flood as well? Says Rabbeinu Bechaya, why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu tell him to spend 120 years of his life building a teva when in the ultimate outcome of the whole story, it was obviously a miracle that he was saved anyway? And the answer is because we have to do whatever we can, al pi derech ha-teva, not to rely on miracles. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to kick in later, that is what it is, which is why we find Moshe Rabbeinu himself, the Ramban writes on Chumash, why is it at the very beginning of Parshas Bamidbar, Moshe Rabbeinu takes a census of the Jewish people? What's that all about, says the Ramban? Because now they were very close to going into Eretz Yisrael. And the problem is when you go into Eretz Yisrael, you're going to have to fight wars, and you're going to have enemy armies. Well, we need to know what kind of fighters we have. We need to know how many able-bodied men we have to fight the war. How's Moshe Rabbeinu supposed to know that? So Moshe Rabbeinu has to take a census of the Jewish people, and then he'll have an understanding of what we're dealing with. Ask the Ramban, why did Moshe Rabbeinu have to do that? Ultimately, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the one who made the miracle that they were going to win the war anyway. There were powerful armies that were destroying them. And yet the Jewish people won the war. How could it be? It must be it was a miracle. But yet, Moshe Rabbeinu had to do what every army does. What does every army do? They make sure they have all the armaments that they need. They make sure they have an army that's set up. They have enough people who are ready to go out to battle. And Moshe Rabbeinu did the same, which is the same theme that the Ramban writes by the Meraglim, which is, when it comes to the story of the Meraglim, why did Moshe Rabbeinu have to do it? And the answer was because he wanted to do as much as he possibly could to make sure that everything was al pi derech ha-teva. When you have a country that's about to take over another land, another piece of space, Obviously, they have to go out first and see what the landscape is, understand what they're in for. Moshe Rabbeinu said, we're going to do what every other commander of an army would do. We will do the same, even though we know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in the end, did the miracle for them, and they got Eretz Yisrael shelo kederech hateva, but still Moshe Rabbeinu felt it had to be that way. So Rabbi Avadia Yosef has an interesting tshuva where he discusses about a man who came to him, and the doctors had told him that he was not allowed to fast on Yom Kippur because he was really not well. He was in a very precarious state in his health-wise, so he was very concerned. And this man said, I'm going to fast Yom Kippur anyway. He didn't want to listen to the doctors. So he asked Rabbi Avadia Yosef what to do. It was a whole discussion what to do, but in the middle of that tshuva, Rabbi Avadia writes, obviously, you should not be machmir. Obviously, you should listen to what the doctors are telling you. However, he says in the middle, Bizman hazeh, shenistam kol chazon, vihistayma v'nifsika hanavua miYisrael. We don't have Nevi'im roaming around the streets. We don't have people on those kinds of levels. Muchuyavim lihisnaig alpi atzas harofim. While it's true, when you had a Navi, you can go to the Navi and say, listen, the doctor tells me this. What does God say to do? I can turn to the Navi and ask for guidance. But when we don't have that today, you cannot behave in such a fashion. You have to work based on Derech HaTeva. Which is why the Rishonim say, Ravos machshavos b'levi ish v'atzas Hashem hisakom. So what does that mean? It means we plan, we have a whole idea of how life is going to pan out for us. And in the end, Atzas Hashem Hitakum. In the end, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will is really what comes through. So ask the Meiri, maybe you'll say, if the end, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's plan is going to come through, so why do anything in life? Why not just sit back and let HaKadosh Baruch Hu's plan pan out? Let it just be what it is. Says the Meiri, no, that's not what it means. Atzas Hashem Hitakum means, if in the end, HaKadosh Baruch Hu decides the plan is different than what you had in mind, don't get frustrated. Don't get upset. But that doesn't mean that you don't have a plan. It doesn't mean you don't do anything. You have to plan. You have to do something. In fact, I was reminded today, one of the klalos, one of the curses that you find in Chumash when it's talking about the terrible state of the Jewish people. So in Chumash, we find that we're told that one of them is going to be that people are not going to have tvua mishana l'shana. People are not going to have produce that is saved from one year to the next. Why is that a curse? HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to save you. The answer is, because most normal people like to know how they're going to eat tomorrow. They don't live day to day. Yes, there are some select individuals that live with a bitachon like this, but that's not the way it's supposed to be. That's a klala. The way it's supposed to be, it's not a klala to have bitachon. It's a klala for a person to live that way. Day to day, they don't know what's going to be. The answer is, the right way to live is, you should plan. And Rav Moshe talks about this in a tshuva when he says about buying insurance. How can I have life insurance? How can I have health insurance? What do you mean? You have no bitachon? The answer is no. That's what a Baal bitachon is supposed to do. You do what you do. HaKadosh Baruch Hu will do the rest of it. But we need to do what we need to do regardless. So that is with regard to the first piece of this. The Beis HaLevi writes in Parshas Miketz in a Sefer on Chumash. Why is it that the Torah said we need to do a hishtadlus? The question is very compelling. If you have bitachon, if you have emunah, then why do anything? So the Beis HaLevi explains, because lo kol adam yachol lahagia lemadreyas habitachon hagamur. Most average people are not able to live that kind of life. They can't go into every day saying, I don't know if the man is going to fall today or not. I don't know if I'm going to die today because I have nothing to eat and I have no shelter and I have nowhere to go. Most people can't live like that. And therefore, says the Beis HaLevi, HaKadosh Baruch Hu set it up, al kein hutar lo hishtadlus kedei sheyia lo siyua. That a person is supposed to do hishtadlus, that this way you have a way to engage life, you have a way to deal with a problem, to deal with an issue, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu will do what he'll do. But the Beis HaLevi explains, most of us are not on that level to be able to say, Hashlech al Hashem Yahavcha, I'm just going to throw it up all to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and leave it as is. Now, although it's true that we have to have our hishtadlus, we need to be involved and we need to take advantage of the different opportunities that are given to us by HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself, the Rashba warns us. And the Rashba had a shayla and somebody asked, how am I allowed to go to a doctor? If HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants me to be sick, I should be sick. If he wants me to get better, I'll get better. So what's the point of a doctor? And the answer, says the Rashba, is Arur HaGevar Sheyiftach Ba'adam. Cursed is a person who puts all of his faith, all of his trust in a human being. So of course, says the Rashba, you're supposed to go to the doctor. You do what a natural means to deal with the problem is supposed to be. But beyond that, you realize it's all in the hands of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the Chafetz Chaim has a very interesting mashal to explain this. And he says, imagine you have two family members who are traveling and they're about to go make a train. But one of them is a very elderly person walking very slowly and he has a younger grandchild who's walking together with him. They're holding hands. And they realize the train is already at the station, and at the pace that they're walking, there's no way they're going to make it. And they're slowly inching along, and he doesn't know what to do. He can't pick his grandfather up. He's not strong enough. So what does he do? He tells the grandfather, you keep walking, you have a cane, you walk at the right pace, healthy, I'm going to run ahead and try to negotiate that they should hold the train. So what does he do? He goes to the ticket counter and he tells them, you know, my grandfather is here and he's walking very slowly. We need to make the train. We have a wedding that we need to get to. If we miss the train, we're going to have to wait a whole other day. If we miss the flight, what's going to be? So he goes to the ticket counter. He starts talking to them. The teller says, I just sell tickets. I'm not the conductor. So maybe it would be helpful if you didn't talk to me, but maybe you should speak to someone who's there on the platform. Maybe they can help you. And he starts rushing. He's in a tizzy. He doesn't know what to do. He starts roaming around and he sees that there's some kind of personnel who's there on the platform. He goes over to him. He says, you know, my grandfather over there is coming with me to the train, but he's walking very slowly. You see, he can't really walk much quicker than that. He doesn't know what to do. We're going to miss the train. If we miss it, we're going to miss the wedding. How are we going to get there? What's going to be? We have to wait another day. He says, listen, I would be so happy to help you. The problem is I'm not the conductor. And each one sends him to another. In the end, he finally tries to find the conductor all the way at the front of the train, and he's waving his hands. By that time, the conductor already left. The only person who can help you in the end, with all of your hishtadlus, with everything you're trying to do to make the meaningful experience that you want to have, ultimately the only one who's going to help you is the conductor. Says the Chafetz Chaim, you can talk to everybody along the way, and they're going to help direct you. The ticket counter is going to send you to the personnel on the platform. Person on the platform is then going to send you to the conductor. But ultimately, you have to realize it's the conductor you need to talk to. And that's, he says, the synthesis. That is the balance that we have to have between our hishtadlus and the bitachon in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the understanding that it is the Ribono Shel Olam who provides us with all of it. Now, the slightly confusing part of all of this is it sounds neatly packaged, but it's really not. Because the Gemara says in Maseches Sota, Rabbi Lezer HaGadol is of the opinion, Kol Mishi Yesh Lo Pas Besalo. If somebody has food, somebody ate dinner tonight, and now his refrigerator is empty, and he has no food in the house, and he has no parnasa. Va'omer, and he says, Ma Ochal Amachar. Person says to himself, well, I just had a delicious meal tonight. The problem is, what am I going to eat tomorrow? Says the Gemara, Eino Ela Miktane Amana. That means you have a very poor sense of belief in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What are you worried about? What's your concern? Now, if I had no food in the house, of course I'd be concerned. So what's the Gemara saying? Are we supposed to stock up and make sure that we're taken care of? Or do you just throw everything in the hands of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and say he's going to take care of it? So it is a little bit confusing. So there are a number of Mefarshim who say that that Gemara means a Midas Chasidus. If you're that kind of person that lives life on such a high Madrega that you're so connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then for you to go out and say, I have nothing in the refrigerator, I have no food in my house, what am I going to do tomorrow? That would be a chisaron in your amunah. But for most of us, the Mefarshim say, obviously this is not applicable. And Rav Moshe discusses this, and he says, what exactly is our perspective supposed to be? It's a little bit delicate, but Rav Moshe says, what it means is we need to do everything possible to take care of ourselves. And we need to have something in the refrigerator to make sure that next time around we're going to be able to eat something. But Rav Moshe says, what happens when the plan fails and things don't go the way we want them to? That's where your bitachon kicks in. You believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants it to be this way. And that, says Rav Moshe, is what the balance is all about. It's interesting when you think about the parshiyos that we're reading now and you compare and contrast. You know, people ask all the time, so I'm single. How much hishtadlus am I supposed to do? How many weekends can I go on? How many shadchanim am I supposed to meet? How much am I supposed to travel to the other end of the world to meet somebody? What should I do? How much hishtadlus is considered appropriate, and when do you say you stop? Somebody doesn't have children, and they say, how many rounds of failed IVF should I go through? What should I do? How many times should I go through the treatments? How many times should I trouble myself? How many flights should I go on to travel to all the clinics all over the country and all over the world? What should I do? What's interesting is, you look in Chumash itself, in these parshios that we're reading, and you find the hishtadlus for the very same objective is not always going to be the same by each personality. Just take for one example, and again, this is just one example, but you find it so often. This is the million-dollar question. How do you strike the balance between when it's appropriate and when do you say it's too much? For example, we find in a few parshios from now, Yosef HaTzadik, as he's leaving the jail, as the two Sarah Mashkim Sarofim, he says, don't forget about me. Rashi says from the Medrash, he was criticized for that. What do you mean? Isn't that minimal hishtadlus? Isn't that what he's supposed to do? So Rashi says, no, that was going too far. So what? That's going too far? It would seem to me, again, I'm not the Medrash, but it would seem to me that that's the basic hishtadlus a person should do. What else should he do? So that's one example, but particularly in these parshios, let's say this week's parsha, when we have Yitzchak Avinu gets married. So he looks for a shidduch. Does Yitzchak do anything to help himself get married? No. Nothing. No hishtadlus at all. What happens? His father says, you know, Yitzchak, it's time to get married. By the way, Yitzchak is not a little kid at the time. He's an adult. He's a mature adult. So it's not like he needed Avraham Avinu to tell him, by the way, it might be a good idea to start dating. He was mature enough. But he did nothing. He believed if HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants him to get a girl, he'll find her. If he wants him to get married, he'll find the person who's appropriate for him to marry. So what happens? Avraham Avinu sends Eliezer. How many questions does he tell him to ask? He just says, make sure that she should be from this community. Outside of that, we'll figure it out. HaKadosh Baruch Hu will find the person who's appropriate. Eliezer comes to the town. What does he ask? One question. What's the question? Bas mi'at. What kind of family do you come from? Is that an appropriate hishtadlus? Would you go on a date and ask the potential match, I have nothing that I need to know about you. All I need to know is, who are your parents? Where do you come from? Oh, those are your parents? Great. Shidduch, let's get married. What kind of hishtadlus is that? What is that? And yet it works. And not only does it work, the pasuk says, he brings her back, ha'oela sara imo. He brings Rivka into the tent, and Rashi says, it was such a great shidduch, it reminded him of sara imenu. It was perfect. HaKadosh Baruch Hu made sure just the right person came. So what do you have? You have Yitzchak Avinu who does minimal to zero hishtadlus to get married, and it works. Contrast that with the next parsha. Who's the next one to get married? Yaakov Avinu. What does he do? What does he do? He says, I'm not taking chances. I'm going to go on my own and find a shidduch. He goes and he travels and he tries to look for someone traveling to Haran. As he's there, he says, you know, when I go on a date, I'm going to have to take the girl out to eat. I'm going to have to take her out to something, right? So I better bring some money along. I need a credit card. So what does he do? Medrash says he brings along Avanim Tovos Samar Galios. He brings money along with him. What happens along the way? Eliphaz comes along, and he robs everything from him. Now he's penniless, he has nothing. Anochi holich hariri, I have nothing. What am I going to do with penny? So all of your hishtadlus, you went and you took money along with you, you're traveling out of town, you want to go find the girl, you want to take her out to eat, you want to have money to take care of her, and you're left with nothing. What happens? Not enough hishtadlus. He continues to go on the path, and as he's there, he meets Lavan. And he says to Lavan, you know, I'm really trying to meet a young woman, and I think your daughter might be the right person. So, let's make a deal. I'm going to work for her for 7 years. That's a pretty wild amount of hishtadlus. And what happens? He says, that's not enough. I'm going to do more hishtadlus. He says to Lavan, I'm not just going to work 7 years. I want Rachel Bitcha HaKetana. I want your daughter Rachel, who's not just your daughter, the youngest daughter. Don't trick me. Don't anything. He tries everything. And what happens in the end? After he gives her the simanim and all the things that he tries to set up that the shidduch should be perfect, it's not perfect. He gets the wrong person. He wakes up in the morning and it's Leah. With all of his ishtadlus, it ends up being the wrong one. And he has to go again and work 7 years. And I think this just highlights the fact that sometimes ishtadlus from one person to the next is not always going to be an equal or even formula. It's not always so simple. HaKadosh Baruch Hu expects us to do a ishtadlus, but it's not so easy to really figure out how to draw the line and how to figure out what is appropriate and what is considered to be going above and beyond too much, that we've taken almost everything out of the hands of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and left it only to ourselves to figure out. Sometimes that's inappropriate. So back to our story here. What do we say after the husband has already extracted his zera? Would we say that it still belongs to him? Again, the shaila was, we have a situation here where this couple was told they're not going to be able to naturally conceive. The husband is adamant. He does not want to go ahead with IVF treatments. He says, I have bitachon, I have amuna, which, by the way, is treif to say such a thing. There's a reason why HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us these gifts. There's a reason why the Ribbono Shel Olam allows us this incredible bracha of having IVF for those who need it. So let's put a plug in for the wife of an IVF specialist who's here, runs a great clinic. Extend for those who ever need it. You should just know there are a lot of great Jews who are dealing with these issues and really helping out so many of us. So here the situation was, she wants to know, can she fool her husband? Can they be intimate? And then she will go to a clinic and have the Zera HaBal extracted, and then go ahead and have an IVF done without telling her husband. Again, the Shalom Bayis is another piece. But the question is, does it belong to the husband, al pi chosha mishpat? Does it belong to him once it's no longer connected to his body? So it reminds us of a story in Tafshin Nun Beis in 1991. There was a fascinating story that happened in Eretz Yisrael. What was the story? There was a family by the name of Nachmeni. The Nachmeni family had extensive attempts to conceive naturally, many, many different types of interventions. In the end, this woman needed to have a hysterectomy because they discovered a cancerous tumor and they had to take out the whole uterus. However, they had had an egg retrieval and ultimately they had fertilized them to create an embryo. They had frozen the embryos and they waited for the appropriate time when they were going to be able to. Now, she had to go ahead with this treatment and therefore they weren't able to do it at the time. But they did have in mind at some point to figure out what to do with those embryos, and they were frozen. In the interim period, the couple got divorced. And now they got divorced, so they were dealing with that. The husband then got remarried, had a child with his second wife, and this woman couldn't find the shidduch. And she was devastated. Not only did she lose her husband, she's now divorced, but she now can't have a child either. She doesn't know what to do. So she decided to go back and to take that frozen embryo, and she wanted to pay for a surrogate mother to carry the embryo so that she can have a child. And the husband totally objected, and he said, how can you allow such a thing? That embryo belongs to me also. I don't want to have another child in the world. I don't want to have another child that is going to be your child. I don't want to be connected to you. We got divorced already. At the time that we got divorced, we had no children. Do you have a right to take something that started off belonging to me and now use it for your purposes? Now I'm going to have to worry about it. She said, it's not your problem. You're not going to have to pay to support this child at all. It's my child. And he said, yeah, but you're taking something that came from my body. So that was a major, major dispute in the Supreme Court in Israel in 1991, whether or not we would say that the Zera HaBal actually belongs to him. Do we assume that it belongs to him, or do you say, no, what was done is done, and now it's over, now it's a whole new story? So this was a very, very intricate discussion at the time. Now, we don't have time to go through the whole issue, but the truth is, there is a discussion in general. The Rambam says, quoting a Gemara, if somebody walks into a Beis Din and says, I owe someone else $1,000, $1,000,000, do we believe that person when they say that? What? Yes, we believe them. Why not? No reason not to believe them. A person says, I don't just owe them $1,000, I stole $1,000, and that's why I owe it to them. We also believe them. We still believe them. Now, we're not going to punish them. We're just going to say, give back the money. If you're saying you owe $1,000, we'll trust you. Give it back. So that's what we do. What if a person walks into Beis Din and says, I'd like everyone to know, I'm embarrassed to say this, but I'm making a confession. I murdered somebody else. And therefore, as a result, I deserve the death penalty. And we have no evidence, and we have no video cameras, and we have nothing to prove it other than his own words. Would we take his word for it and say, okay, if you say so, no, then we should kill you? No. So no, why not? Says the Gemara, we have a rule. Ain't other Mesim Atzma Russia. So we're not going to believe you when you say that. We're not going to believe you when you say that, but we believe you when you say about your money. Why not? What's different about my money and myself? So the Rambam discusses this, and the Radvaz breaks it down into layman's terms, and he says, the answer is, your body doesn't belong to you. Your money does belong to you. You worked hard, you earned money, you decided whatever you want to do with it. You want to say you owe someone $1,000 even though you don't? That's your problem. You can do whatever you want with your money. But your body? Your body doesn't belong to you. Hanefashos lihena, the Pasuk says. Your body belongs to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You have no right to decide how to use or treat your body. That is not something that's an appropriate decision for you to make because it doesn't belong to you. And the same way I'm not able to make a decision about $1,000 that's your money, I can't come into Beis Din and say, you owe someone else $1,000. What do I know? It's not true. I'm not allowed to be mechayiv you money. I can take from my own money and give it to someone else. I can't take someone else's money and give it away. So too, says the Radvaz, hanefashos lihena. Our bodies belong to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, not to us. And therefore we assume that a person's body is not up to his discretion to decide what to do with it, which is why Rav Moshe has a scathing tshuva against people who decide to donate organs after they have passed away. And he says, who said you have a right to make that determination? Who said you have a right to say, I'm going to donate my organs? So you say, well, my organs belong to me. I can do whatever I want with them. Says Rav Moshe, they don't belong to you. The Torah says, kavur tikberenu bayamahu. The Torah says you should bury a body after it passes away, after it's no longer alive. So you don't have a right to say, well, I want to do otherwise because I have a right to decide. Now you'll ask, then how can I ever donate a kidney? Also a question. So that's a big discussion. Why am I allowed to do that? Obviously, that's not a cadaver donor. That's a live donor. But that's a very, very important question that really comes down to this issue. How much would you say really depends on the person because you say, my body belongs to me? And how much would you say, no, it doesn't belong to you at all, and therefore you have no right to have any demands or claims on anything that's a part of your body because it really is not in your possession? There was a fascinating story in Tufshin Ayin Beis, another interesting story, that there was a woman who had also a number of fertilized embryos. And one party, the husband or the wife, I forgot what it was exactly, but one of them claimed that they wanted to get rid of them because they were no longer going to have any children in the future. And the other party said, no, like, let's hold on to them, let's see what happens. So the question there was, again, who has a right to decide? This is actually a big shaila in the Israeli army. There was a time when there was a big discussion among many of the young chayalim. They were afraid that, Rachmana Litzlan, that God forbid, they would lose their lives at a very young age. And that was scary to them. Obviously, naturally, it's scary. It's terrifying. So they didn't know exactly what to do, but somebody came up with an idea, and that was they should all do a sperm donation beforehand, which halachically is not permissible, but many of them were chilonim. And they said that they wanted to do a sperm donation before. They were not married. And they said this way, if Chalila v'chas, they should be killed at battle at 19 years old and never have the opportunity to get married, at least you could take the sperm and later on have a child that can be born from me, that at least I should have some kind of remembrance in the world. Somebody should live on after me as a result of the sperm donation that I did. So that was a big, big question because there was a young man who was married who had done a sperm donation before he went out to war, and then he was killed. And his wife and his parents got into a big disagreement. The parents said, we want to have a grandchild. We want to have someone who will perpetuate the legacy of our child who was just killed. The wife said, I feel terrible saying no, but I have to be honest. I lost my husband, which was tragic, but I'm a young woman. I'm 19 years old. Maybe I'll be able to move on. If I have a child in the world from him, it's going to be so uncomfortable. I don't want to have to hold on to that memory and that feeling for the rest of my life. And this went also to the Supreme Court in Israel, where they were trying to figure out who actually owns this. Who does it belong to? Someone does a sperm donation. Who does that belong to? I actually asked this shaila to my father about the issue that we're talking about here, and he said he doesn't think there would be any problem. The couple may have many other problems that they need to think about and deal with, but he said in terms of this issue in Chosha Mishpat, would we say that it's stealing from the husband to go ahead and do that? Perhaps it's not. So it's interesting. Rabbi Isaac Rice, who was also involved in this discussion this week, so Rabbi Rice said, let's say you have a woman who really wants to have a child and her husband doesn't want to. And he thinks she's on birth control and she decides, I'm going to stop taking the pills and just not tell him. And then, oops, you know, she becomes pregnant. And her husband thinks that it's just one of those things. Sometimes you have a fluke that you're on a pill and it just doesn't work. So Rabbi Rice said, would that be shaloka halacha for a woman to do that? Her husband doesn't want to have another child. She's dying to have another kid. She realizes there's no way she's going to be able to convince him. So, you know what? I'll just come off the pills and I won't tell him. So would that be similar? Would that be the same? Would it be different? So Rabbi Leibowitz felt maybe it would be different in this case because here the husband wants to have a child. He's in agreement with his wife that he wants to have a child. The only thing is they're disagreeing about the mechanism. So here, what's the problem? Either way, if she has the child and she doesn't tell her husband, he thinks his emuna was wonderful and it worked. She thinks her IVF was perfect and it worked. What's the difference? In the end, they have the result they want. They both wanted a child and they have it. In that case, where the husband doesn't want to have a child and the wife does, maybe that's a little bit different. You're tricking him to do something which he's going to end up having to pay for, which he really doesn't want. Maybe potentially that would be different. I don't know. I'm not exactly sure. My father definitely felt in this case it would be permissible al pi halacha for the woman to do this, even though again, it comes along with many, many different kinds of complications and many layers of issues that go along with this, but I thought it was a fascinating issue to think about and something to consider. I don't have conclusive answers of how to work out exactly who it belongs to, but I think it's a very interesting issue to think about. Yeah.